here, I kind of close right on Mary. These were by my people that the agents be about to give to the school, shall be a church, a whole church, and nothing but the church.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Berry. Can you please confirm to the court that your full name is Rayon Paul Berry?
That's true.
And your chef and best partner in the Waipai FMU, and also the main full chair for the Waipai Federated Farmers?
Yep.
You have completed two statements of evidence, one dated 28 July 2023, and a statement of rebuttal evidence dated 11 August 2023.
Yes.
And they are found at tabs 13 and 14 of volume 304. Do you have any corrections that you wish to make to your evidence?
Yes, I have a couple. Paragraph 53 on the first law of evidence. Says in there, it shows improvements in water clarity, sediment, and phosphorus. That's not actually what that shows. It just shows an improvement in phosphorus. It shows a decline in water clarity.
So we'll delete water clarity / sediment and.
Yeah, it shows improvement in phosphorus.
Yeah, thank you.
And then declines in, you can add clarity, water clarity, sediment, under E. coli and nitrates. So,
thank you.
Also on paragraph 127, which would be
page 38.
Page 38, yep. Says there about two thirds of the way down, we don't feed our failage during winter. It's not quite correct because we do feed our failage on a crop during winter. If you inserted, we don't feed our failage onto pasture during winter, would be a bit more correct. Then on paragraph 149, there's a table there that shows our four properties. Down at Mangakiwa, near the bottom, it says four springs. That should actually say three springs. Seems to have a bit of evidence, so it's used to pass the goals here. Paragraph 206 is the last one. On the fourth line, it says $165 per hour plus GST. That's not the digger price. The digger price, it should say $150 per hour plus GST. It's just come out of one of the answers at the back. The wrong number's been put in there.
And with those corrections, Mr. Berry, do you confirm your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes.
And you attended the Farm Systems expert conference and signed the joint witness statement dated 13 September 2023, didn't you?
I did.
And finally, before answering any questions, can you turn to Annexure RV19 of your primary evidence in the bundle that's page 304-0967? And on your document, Mr. Greer, I think that's page 329. Could you explain the origins of that farm plan?
This farm plan came about firstly because of our involvement in NZ Fat Plus, or New Zealand Farm Assurance Program Plus pilot back in, might have been during, before COVID and during COVID. So we're one of the, with other farmers in our area, we're involved in a pilot to develop the NZ Pet Plus program. We had some, there was some money made available to us to do something on our farm. Some people chose to look at their, get an eco biologist to come and look at some of their bush and look at what's in it. We chose to get our farm LUC mapped, just to find out about that. The lady that came and did the LUC mapping, she also develops, well, she's got an interest in developing farm environment plans. Her name is actually on the first page there, it was prepared by Sarah Dooley. So as part of that, we said to her, well, okay, once you've got the LUC going, then could you please help us develop a farm environment plan to basically bring all the information that we already had lying around the place into one place and make it a document that we could look at in one place rather than having to search through all our files on our computer. So this is one of four. I didn't want to burden you with having to read all of them. They're all, I gave you the shortest one to look at for the smallest property, but there are, this is, the other properties have got a farm environment plan like this as well. And yeah, it wasn't prepared with PC1 in mind. It does mention PC1. It took the LUC mapping is a lot of work. There was 3 days on farm with Sarah Duden, and then she developed the rest of it off the back of that. It's been good. It's got some actions in there. It's not a finished product as far as a PC1 plan would be, or a freshwater farm plan for that matter. But it's a long way towards it. Probably the thing that's in there that's gold-plated is the LUC mapping at farm level. We wanted that just to see what the story was, because we didn't feel that the regional level mapping was detailed enough. So and we got some interesting results out of it.
Can I just ask there, Ms. Edwards, Mr. Gary, having got the LUC mapping done, did that lead you to make any adjustments to what you were doing on the farm?
Not yet. For this particular one, all of them actually, it confirmed what we already knew. I was more, the thing that was interesting to me, being a little bit of an amateur geologist, was the underlying soil and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
That was quite interesting reading. But no, it didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. We know what's on our farm and what should be run where. There were no great surprises.
But in terms of that answer, had you found out that classifications were different in an area, you would have gone back and revisited the activity on that area?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that, well, we already had a map that gave us land management units as to what we were running where. When you overlay that over the LUC map, it's a tiny match. So yeah, it just reinforces that we're on the right track, running appropriate stock in appropriate places. It wasn't free. It cost us $22,000 to do those four farm environment plans. It's a part of our involvement with catchment group stuff. We've sort of been farm environment planning has been a big focus of ours. Catchment group work, trying to find good ways for farmers to be involved with farm planning, how to keep the cost right. It's probably don't need to go into it here, but someone asked me, I'll tell you. But we want farmers to be able to develop a farm plan on their own as far as they can, to save cost, and then if they need help, bring it in. Because there's a lot of stuff farmers know already about their farms. They just sometimes need workshops together or a bit of facilitation to get it down on paper.
the second thing I wanted to ask you about is Pharaoh Farmer's invited the planners to visit your farm. Mr. Trevoco, Ms. Kissick, and Mr. Willis and Ms. Foster took up that offer and visited your property. You also attended one day back here in Auckland, and you heard Mr. Trevoco mention that your farm was an outlier. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I'll take a bit of umbrage with that comment from it. It is an outlier in that it's at the edge of the catchment, but I think he might have been insinuating that my farm is somehow steeper than most or different to most other farms. I really don't think that's the case. It's a fairly typical example of any hill country farm in the Waitomo district or the Okahoma district or the Western Hills or the Waipar or anywhere else where there's sheep and beef farming of that class of country, which is the middle class of hill country in the North Island. It's actually I've got a fair idea that we're acreage because we're a beef and lamb economic service farm. We're a survey farm for that. So we are class 4 North Island hill country. There's a class 3, which is North Island hard hill country. That's a steeper and tougher class of country to farm than our own. And there's also a class 5, which is an easier class of country in the North Island. So yeah, we're an average farm. We're above average for size, but we're bang on. Our stock units that we run per hectare is dead average. We put on usual fertiliser application. Our expenditure, on-farm expenditure per hectare is average. Our gross farm revenue is actually slightly above the average. And our lambing percentage is slightly above average as well. Although the last couple of years drought hammered that back a little bit. We run slightly below average cattle stock units than our class of farm, but yeah, on the whole, I get around the countryside a bit, and our farm's not really that much different to a lot of farms and faces a lot of the same challenges that the rest of the hill country sheep beef farms are going to face with PC1 around the edge of the catchment.
Thank you, Mr. Berry. Can you please answer any questions my friends on the court have?
Thank you. I think so. Just too much.
No, thank you, sir.
You? River Authority? No. Mr. Pennell?
Yes, I have one. We won't talk about your farm and whether it's rougher or steeper, but your representation role, you get around the Waikato and wearing the head's hat. Just in terms of feedback you've had from North Waikato, it probably would be helpful if you could explain what sort of consultation and feedback you've done within the Whangarino catchment and what sort of concerns are coming from farmers in that catchment.
Yeah, there was something in my evidence referring to a meeting that was held at Pohiniwai. I guess part of the problem with feedback from PC1 is that unfortunately the decisions version of PC1 came out when we went into lockdown, and I and other sheep and beef farmers and dairy farmers, I guess any farmer within the PC1 catchment that are aware of PC1 know that farmers out there don't know a lot about it at the moment, and there's going to be a big hill to climb with farmers to re-socialise the idea that PC1 hasn't just gone away, it's just been hidden in a court process. Hidden might be the wrong word, but failed, let's say. So there haven't been a lot of comms coming out of the regional council or any of the farming groups. thought process, so I do worry a little bit. And yeah, you're referring to Bomberino especially. There was a meeting at Hiniwai, and it became pretty obvious pretty early. It was an information sharing meeting, but at that meeting, it could get a bit heated, and there's a lot of farmers are unaware of the decision's version, the PC one, and they weren't overly happy to find out that the whole Whanganui Merino area was any farmer there would go into a restricted discretionary activity. I think it's probably been, it'd be fair to say that if I was a low intensity sheep and beef farmer, or a low intensity, or even a moderate sheep and beef or moderate dairy farmer in that region, in that area, those six sub catchments that make up the Whanganui catchment, I'd be upset that I'm suddenly going from a permitted activity on my farm to facing a restricted discretionary activity. Notwithstanding, I understand that Whanganui wetland is an internationally recognised site and all that goes with that, but that is a big leap, and I would especially urge the regional council to, if that's how it lands, they've got some work in front of them to educate people about that. It shouldn't. It's a surprise to people at the moment. They're a bit cross. Maybe they're going to have the same reaction I had when PC1 first came out. You sort of go through a bit of anger and grief and then get over the sulks and get on with life. But there's a lot of farmers out there in these catchments that are not only in the farm arena, but they're going to be facing all those feelings with a pretty limited time frame to get over it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pennell. Ms. Margaret, what are your questions? No, thank you. Mr. Robbins?
No, thank you.
No, thank you. Fish and Game, Solomon.
Thank you. And there you talk about the link between farm environment bans and sub-catchment contextual information and Federated Farmers have proposed a new method which is 3.11, well it's in its existing method but there is a couple of minor changes that Federated Farmers wish to make to it. It's method 3.11.3.6, which would require the regional council to provide information to farmers, which is interim target attribute states, current attribute states, reduction required, and the contaminants of most concern. And you would have heard my questions this morning to Mr. McGibbon that some of those attribute states might be changing in a 2024 plan change, if we assume that that December 2024 date remains the same. So you're aware of that too, aren't you?
Yes, I'm aware that there's a review going on about it.
And some sub-catchment attribute states in those current tables may need to be changed significantly, including those in Lakes catchments. So do you think that, as I asked Mr. McGibbon, that sort of messaging should be clear to the farming sector?
process anyway. Plan change one is under any illusion that there's not going to be something that follows it and again and again for 80 years. I couldn't really comment on what you're asking. It's not. It's good. I think this plan change stands on its own, but we know there's something coming after it, so.
Yeah, it does. And my question was also that Christian Games thinks that the plan should be clear on its face that there is something coming after it.
I seem to remember in one version that it did mention something somewhere about further changes necessary in the future. Quite where that was in the plan change or which version, I don't know. I've got about five of them at home.
Right, well, we'll move on from that. The second topic I wanted to talk to you about was about the potential future allocation of nutrients, and you would have heard your lawyer flag that in his legal submissions this morning. And at the council level hearings, Beef and Lamb put forward an LUC allocation approach. Were you involved in that?
No.
You weren't? Okay. Are you concerned at all about grandparenting existing farms that have high leaching of nitrogen and phosphorus? Do you know what I mean by grandparenting?
Yes.
Are you concerned at all if that sort of approach is entrenched for the future? And whether that's an equitable regime for the future?
Yeah, grandparenting is not my favourite thing. I think it's really up to every farmer to make the changes they can on their farm, take care of their own contaminants, improve their properties.
Alright. As a sheep and beef farmer, you would be a lower intensity farm, generally speaking, to dairy farming.
Depends on which measure of intensity you're using, I suppose. But generally, if you're talking about overseer or something like that, then yeah, it would be.
So, just in relation to the nitrogen risk scorecard, the evidence of the farming sector is that it provides to input to the nitrogen risk scorecard, you provide a subset of information as compared to overseer. But it's not exactly clear, there hasn't been a comparative list provided about what that subset of information is that I've seen in the evidence. Would you be concerned if in terms of any future allocation regime, we weren't collecting information, particularly from the dairy sector, that would enable comparisons across sectors and across farms in the future?
I don't really know enough about the nitrogen risk scorecard to comment on it in the joint witness statement. I know more about overseer than I know about the nitrogen risk scorecard, I'm afraid.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Gary.
Thank you. Horticulture is in this board. No, thank you. Brother Ewe, Mr. Ferguson.
Mr. Gerrard, I just wanted to explore one issue, which is your comment, I suppose, about, and not just like the COVID period, but of this process of disappearing behind a veil to some extent, and the challenges of information and communication out to the broader farming community, let alone the wider community as a whole, which is an issue you've identified. That's correct. And obviously you'd appreciate that at the early stages of PC1 and that and Ms. made for the regional council meetings at the beginning of week two regarding the collaborative process. So at that formative stage, there was input from farming representatives. I'm not saying that they represent every group, including the federal farmers, but from the various sectors at various levels of that collaborative process at any stage is very least you acknowledge that.
Yeah, I was not being involved since 2014, so yeah, there's people in this room now that were involved back then, so there has been some shaking. It would be fair to say that the sheep and beef sector was unhappy with the outcome of the CSG, and you well know that the sole sheep and beef representative on the CSG voted against some of the parts of Plan Change 1 as it was. Back then, nothing like this now, though.
No, that's right. And I'm just wondering, just as a matter of observation, whether once we end up into these court processes, not only do they become further removed from the community as a whole, but kind of lose that sense of collaboration. People kind of resort to their corners to some extent as a natural product of these type of litigious processes, isn't it?
Oh, I don't know about that. I came out and got quite involved with federated farmers and tried to bring our sectors together, I would like to say.
I think that was the point I was going to make about the importance of those collaborative processes shouldn't just stop with the plan development, but really the opportunity and the realisation of success is going to require collaboration on an ongoing and iterative basis. Not only through this process, and we are trying to find some common ground, but also in terms of implementation and future plan changes. That's imperative, isn't it, to success?
Yes, it is. If we don't, if people aren't on board with this thing, then it's not going to get anywhere.
And I noticed your reference to your farming experience, and obviously we've got the farm that flows into catchments on the other side as well. You have different regulatory arrangements around some of that, but you talk about your involvement in the catchment community and some of those collective initiatives by farmers within each sub-catchment. Is that common throughout the way of sub-catchments and catchments?
There's certainly catchment groups that probably throughout the Waikato that operate at a slightly smaller scale than Kankati Rookia does. They're not uncommon.
No.
I wouldn't put my hand up and say the whole of BC1 area is covered by a catchment group in some one form or another, because I don't think that would be true.
Yeah. And probably also not true that all farmers are active participants in those catchment communities and their services.
That's right, yeah. Farmers are like any other part of society. There's those that get in there and those that don't, and we've all got an opinion.
That's right. And the challenge is to try and get everybody up to that common standard and goals, and I suppose, longer term.
Yes.
Thank you very much. No further questions.
New re-examination. Mr. Berrien, I just want to pursue something that you said in response to Mr. Pennell's questions, and I know that you were talking specifically about the Whangarino area, the six sub-catchments down there, and the comment about farmers not necessarily being aware that they may need a resource consent as a restricted discretionary activity, going from permitted, which I imagine you would expect to be in the PC1.
Not necessarily.
All right. Do you have any resource consents in relation to your farm operation?
No. We do on our dairy properties.
Right.
But I've got someone else who takes care of that for me.
Right. Okay. I just want to tease out, in terms of, and I know there could well be a variety of reasons, but what are the reasons you can think of why in a catchment or a sub-catchment where there may be some either significant environmental pressures or some sensitive environments,
What in those circumstances would be the objection to going through a consent process?
I think it's the fear of the unknown is part of it. It's not necessarily a new concept.
Okay.
And it feels like when you realise that new concept isn't actually just one step up the ladder, it's two steps up the ladder, that's going to provoke a response. Well, it has.
Right. So in terms of things like the fact it may cost a few thousand or several thousand dollars, or the time it may take, those wouldn't be as significant as thinking it's restricted discretionary, they could turn me down.
Yeah, I think that's a scary word. Yeah, restricted discretionary. They're both two words that somebody who's not familiar with the whole process would say, well, that just doesn't sound good.
Right. If you were aware that in the context of existing activities and requiring a restricted discretionary consent in order to continue that activity without any change, but, well, the change would be a requirement to produce a farm environment plan and to sign up to say that you would adhere to that plan. Would that provide any reassurance, or would they still say, don't like having to go to the council?
I think that, that's too bad, isn't it? I mean, you're going to have to get used to the idea that you're going to the council. So I don't think that's really at play.
Right. Okay.
It's just a new reality.
Well, I mean, that's part of it, but a number of others have said, and I think that the court, the members here of the court accept, this is a relatively new situation, and it would be important that there's a little bit more carrot than stick in terms of trying to get things to change. I suppose the question then is, from your point of view and from your perspective, either your own perspective or your perspective as a representative, what do you think might be done to assist in achieving that?
Well, I don't think it would be uncomfortable to have a change in there to a controlled activity for those low and moderate farmers. Some, if you're a high risk dairy, of course you'll be restricted discretionary anyway. The farm plan's the same farm plan. It's a D2, scheduled D2 farm plan either way.
Yeah.
So I mean that's not the end or the end. But I think it would be helpful for those farmers to feel like they weren't getting singled out, because they're no different to any other farmers apart from the locality. And I think their banks are already up because of some unhelpful media about the Whangarino wetland creature that happened this autumn. So
right.
Not that that's any reason. You'll make the decision you make, but there's going to be some, it's going to be a tricky area.
Okay. You've very helpfully provided a farm environment plan, and you pointed out how it came to be, and that it's not a PC1 farm environment plan. And you've got three others similar, I take it, your other three?
Yeah, just a bit longer.
Right, okay.
A few more actions on the other ones. This is the evidence was done a bit long, so I've sort of put it a short one.
Thank you for that. But you would anticipate, and I think this is what you indicated earlier, that these would be a reasonably good starting point for farm environment plans under either Schedule D1 or D2?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. Yeah, I mean, I say you don't need LUC, you don't need LUC, but that is a risk assessment in itself on the land. Overlay the stock over there, and you're getting a long way towards that risk, that identifies risks in there. It identifies actions as well, and talks about critical source areas and
And I think you say that these plans were done by Ms. Deaton as a particular project. She's not your a regular farm advisor for you?
No, she's not.
Do you have a regular farm advisor?
Yes, we do. Yeah. But when I say regular, we have somebody that we use, that we don't have regular farm meetings.
Okay.
We do.
Somebody who knows your farm, knows your operation, and when you talk to that person, they can immediately understand what you're talking about.
Yes.
Would your neighbours, or the people around that area from the Kim country, would they all generally have that kind of advice?
Maybe not. A lot would.
Right.
And a lot wouldn't. It might be probably more wood than wooded.
Okay.
But, yeah, most people have somebody that they can bounce ideas on.
And is the person that you contact in relation to this, are they certified or are they seeking certification under the freshwater regs?
No, they're definitely not.
Oh.
They're running a mile. Well, they're not running a mile, they've got a role, they see themselves as having a role in helping to develop freshwater farm plans. But most farm consultants, like the one we use, they've already got a job. They're not actually looking for another one.
Well, you've expressed some concern about, for implementation, about there being the systems in place to actually mean that the implementation can occur, haven't you?
Yes, I have, yeah. Farm certifiers, availability and quality of farm certifiers is definitely an area of concern. It's a new thing, so
indeed.
We don't know, obviously don't know what we're going to get, it might all be perfect, but there's certainly a feeling amongst sheep and beef farmers that we would need to. We're used to inviting people onto our farm,
sure,
to come and have a look around, but that's not everybody, that's not every farmer's feelings. Your farm is your property.
Yeah.
So there will be some reluctance. So you want some, if the farm supervisor is somebody you know, that's going to help. If it's somebody who or you know of, that's going to be helpful. If got some background in sheep and beef farming and understand your farm system, that's going to be quite good. Like I don't see how a farm certifier who understands dairy, there's not many consultants out there that are very good at dairy systems and sheep and beef systems. They're quite different. So we're going to need quite a few certifiers.
Indeed. Because you wouldn't want a farmer all set to go and hang up waiting.
Yeah, and I mean our particular situation, which we're not alone in, there's 30 odd farms around the edge of, as far as I can think, that I could name, that all straddle both catchments.
Yep.
And of course, we're facing different stock exclusion rules depending on between PC1 and the national stock regs at the moment.
Right.
So I look at that purple and grey map, and I've got to work out, okay, so which side of the hill are we looking at?
Do your neighbours ask you for references in terms of if they are thinking of doing it, who they might consult?
Well, I don't know who to consult yet. Okay. But I'm not sure who's going to be actually putting their hand up in our area. Well, I don't know of any people personally. Well, I think I know of one that's applied to become a certifier. Two of them, and both got quite different qualifications coming at it from quite different angles. And neither of them are certified yet. So, yeah, it's quite a steady business now. Freshwater farm plans coming along. Like, we're live, part of our, well, this property is live for the freshwater farm plan right now.
Oh.
And there's, it's a hard sell to tell a farmer to go and, go and get your freshwater farm plan done and then come back when you gentlemen make your decision and then add a bit more to it. The PC1 is trying to get people to start collecting the information they're going to need. And obviously, take the help to the regional council for doing it, trying to integrate the freshwater farm plan into this as much as possible. It makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
But until there's always those farmers out there that are they want certainty, our businesses need certainty, and they're not prepared to make the investment until they have got that certainty, which is going to end up catching them out.
Yeah.
They're going to be short of time to do what they need to do.
Thank you. Anything arise from?
No, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your evidence, Mr. Spirit.
Federated Farmers calls Lee Matheson. Shall be approved by full truth and nothing but the truth. Can you please confirm to the court that your full name is Lee Anthony Matheson?
That's correct.
You're a farm systems expert and a managing director at Purinag Limited?
That's correct.
You have completed two statements of evidence, a primary statement of evidence dated 28 July and a rebuttal evidence dated 11 August 2023.
That's correct.
Barrett, volume 304 has given a note. Do you have any corrections that you'd like to make to your evidence?
Yeah, I have one correction. In my evidence in chief, paragraph 3.25, and then the paragraph I describe the process by which we prorate the livestock that were only on hand for public use. In the last sentence, I took about 200 dairy cows on hand the 1 July. But that left on the 15th July, we equate to 1,000 dairy cows being on farm for the month. That should read 100 cows.
And with that correction, do you confirm that your evidence is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
That is correct.
You attended the expert conferencing for farm systems and signed the joint witness statement dated 30 September 2023?
I did.
There have been some questions raised about the stocking rate table in Plan Change 1. Can you provide some comment on where it came from and how it's used in PC1?
Certainly. So I am the author of that table that was prepared for Plan Change 10. And one of the rules in that plan change, which limits farming intensity and rural attachments, it was the table designed to allow people who are considered to be in permanent activity under that rule to be able to easily identify the numbers of livestock they can carry on their property that would allow them to comply with a nitrogen limit, a nitrogen loss limit of 17.9 kilos of egg per hectare. The primary output of that table was actually the number of livestock that you can have per hectare in those various livestock classes, and the stocking rate definitions that came out of that were a secondary output. That table was subsequently picked up by the WRC and included in Plan Change 1, and might use somewhat out of context. There's been a lot of questions or concerns around the fact that both the descriptions of the livestock classes and their stock unit allocation are different from those that have particularly been in common usage. That is correct. It was a table designed to allow compliance officer to describe animals at any stage of the year, not simply just the winter period. And the stock unit definition represents the annualised feed input of those animals, not necessarily just their relative winter feed input. That said, as I described in my evidence, the relativity in the stock unit definitions between the stock classes are more or less consistent with other definitions. And in the perspective of planning by itself, the stock unit table and the dry stock drafting gates are consistent because the dry stock drafting gates were based on a physical number of animals that would be converted into stock units using that table. It would be would it be possible to rework or apply new SOCIM definitions to the last SOC classes they're taking? They would also then require that the drafting gate SOC units be changed as well. As to the joint witness statements, some revisions were made to that table by myself as part of that process to aid in the interpretation of that table by council officers and farmers alike. And I'm reasoning out to it and now does so.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. The other matter I just wanted to raise with you is there have been some questions from the court about the Abacus Viral report that was attached to Mr. Allen's evidence for Fonterra. And are you able to explain to the court why you may be able to provide some assistance if the court still had questions on that report or on the nitrogen risk score?
So back in 2018, I was one of two independent personnel that were engaged by Fonterra to provide an initial peer review of the nitrogen risk score concept. So it was myself and Professor Mike Healy from Massey University. So I have some knowledge of that tool since it was created. I haven't been involved with it since its inception. I have read the Abacus Bio report. And you know, in my view, its findings aren't consistent with what I would expect given the way that that tool was created, the purpose it was created for.
Thank you, Mr. Matheson. Can you please remain seated and answer any questions my friends or the court have?
Afternoon, Mr. Matheson. I just want to start with the SOC unit table that you talked about, but getting one question from your legal counsel. Have you got the curated farmers version of the provisions there that the ones that were attached just provided an opening?
No, I've got a copy of the post-commerce version this time.
You haven't got the curated farmers version? Table starts on page 79 and it runs over onto page 80. And I've just noticed the last two lines of the table are from milk and ewes and milk and goats. So any milk and ewe that as of 1 June will turn a year. Is there a number missing from that?
Sure, I should say it should turn 1 year.
One year
old, apologies, it's done under, I wouldn't say duress, but under the pressure in the lunchtime, right, during the JWS, it's 1 year.
That's fine, but I understand. And again, in that final line there, it comes from an issue. Is that a 1 or a 2 or part 1?
It's actually, it should be. Sorry, it should be 2 years or older.
2 years or older for both of them?
Correct, because they're out of their hours.
Okay.
Thank you.
When we look at Schedule A, Schedule A for F, which is on page 36, and it's drafted by the WRC. It requires property owners with land greater than 4.8 hectares to use their land for grazing to provide their annual stocking rate as well as their winter stocking rate. And annual stocking rate is a defined term the average of 12 monthly average stock unit counts on a property divided by the various hectares of the property, and it was expressed as stock units per hectare and was based on a farm year of 1 July to 30 June in any year. So federated farming speaks to the deletion of the reference to annual stocking rate, and you set out the reasons in support of that in paragraph 8.17, and if I can summarise that, it's basically you see no value in the metric. So that's not a position that's been universally held by all farm systems experts, is it?
I've always disagreed with that. I think someone has said they agree with it, but I don't.
Yes. Okay, so you must be aware that Mr. Brocklesby has said see it as a useful metric.
I'm not aware of his position.
It is what he says in the joint witness statement.
Yep, I'm not aware of his position. Yeah.
Thank you. Now, just putting aside your reservations about the utility of the metric, would it be difficult to get information to calculate and provide?
It would have some challenges for us to interpret what information. Because, some of the systems are pretty complex, so it's not a number that people would have easy to handle, and we would not have a system to easily pull that information out. It's not impossible for
them. So they need to have the average monthly stock counts? Is that?
That's correct. They need to have their actual monthly stock counts, and then you can convert those into a monthly average, and then
right, and that and those average monthly stock counts are not routinely collected, is that?
Well, most farms do not count all their animals on their farm property every month. The reality is they have to go and that would calculate those daily livestock movements from the transactions they undertake, the 10 missing animals they count, they'll add in something to increase regular stock counts that they might occur, and then work out those average monthly averages.
But they only need to do it once we've made it at time of registration, according to these provisions.
According to that provision 4E, correct.
And putting aside the inconvenience or the challenges of doing that calculation, is there any disadvantage to farmers of WRC actually having this information alongside the winter stocking rate?
I mean, it's just a statistical number, and I guess the reality is it's been waiting to see a meaningless number. I think there's going to be plenty of other information that farmers will also be providing the council via their farm environment plans as well, that will provide a significant wealth of information to the council around the number of livestock that farmers are carrying on their properties at one time. I guess the other point is that in isolation it's probably even less valuable. Its real value would be in its regular connection, notwithstanding
okay. Let's move on now to wetlands. Paragraph 3.6 of the rebuttal evidence. You're supported to have a minimum wetland size for stock exclusion of stones. Paragraph 3.6, you're supportive of a minimum wetland size for stock exclusion of 500 square metres.
That's correct.
And I've scored this a bit with Mr. Pennell, but I just want to ask you as well. So these wetlands, and particularly the smaller ones, some of them will have streams flowing in and out of them, is that correct?
Some probably will.
Yeah, and some will be more isolated. On their own. Yeah. Are you able to comment at all on the extent to which the smaller wetlands are connected to rivers and streams in your experience?
I'm not a hydrologist, so. Yeah.
Would you agree with Mr. Pennell that fencing the smaller wetlands, say 50 square metres or thereabouts, would be more practical if they're already connected to streams that are already required to be fenced?
Well, I think that would be fenced if that's the case. So a stream is going through a wetland. The wetland is in my view definitely part of the stream. So my
to the 2 year time frame and the score. I've scheduled Steve. So in your evidence you raise issues with that time frame. It's been too short, and you talk about cost, time, contract availability, and the like. And I think that's it. Around paragraph 4.45. Sorry, 4.45 is your conclusion. You say there that recognising the importance of stock exclusion from low slope land and the crossover of this with national regulations, the 2 year provision for low slope land is not unreasonable.
Correct.
And in that context, by low slope, you mean land less than 10 degrees?
I mean, since the EC1 I took in terms of the natural rates and stuff,
So in that context, it's 10 degrees. So a blanket extension to that 2 year time frame, it could delay progressive fencing on low slope land that could otherwise reasonably be completed, couldn't it?
Well, I think I'm not promoting that it's extended for land, it's not, but I'm not promoting that it's necessarily reduced the land at low slope land. I think most farmers, I mean, the large, a lot of majority of land will already be fenced, and this land is easier to fence. Because there's a reasonable crossover with the national regulations. There's already an expectation that farmers will comply with that and do so.
Okay, so most of the natural things within 2 years?
I'm comfortable with that, similar things.
And you're going to suggest a 5 year time frame for high slope land greater than 10 degrees? And do you think there could be some farms on high slope land that could deal with the 2 year time frame?
I don't. There may well be, but I guess it comes down to what else those farmers have to deal with in terms of land change, what anything else going on in their farm businesses. So I think it's going to be that would be a role by, I think, the certification process of how do you define in terms of the growers that farm.
Yeah, and just expand on those variables that could affect their ability to comply within 10 years. The financial resources of them, how long?
15 years.
Sorry, within 2 years. Apologies.
Yes, that's what I wanted to talk about today, just the availability of materials and to do their work. That land that's a high contour is more expensive to defence in the first place, and land that is to be unfenced probably has additional requirements of a lot of water reticulation as well, so it's not just putting up a fence. Putting in a network of troughs to supply water off in many cases, and with all the challenges of conveying water and altitude and stuff to those locations. So there's a number of things. And most farmers already have, as I've said, but all businesses, they have high demands of capital across their businesses, so it's just how they prioritise that.
Yeah, and there's a focus spectrum here, isn't there? There's from a simple scenario with a relatively small length of waterways to fence, good access to fencing materials, contractors, strong financial position, they might find it quite possible. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where it's going to be difficult for them to comply.
Then you find that some farmers that already have, that does just already fence their waterways is greater than 10 degrees. So yes, there'll be a wide range.
And those that at that long end of the spectrum, who could comply with the 2 year time frame, they might choose to defer their expenditure if they don't have to spend the money here and now. They might choose to defer it to 5 years if that were allowed.
I don't know, maybe they would, but maybe they would not either. So you have to ask them to define that question.
Yeah. And if they did choose to defer it in that way, that would slow down progress in improving water quality, wouldn't it?
Depends what else has to be capital on. So it's an assumption that capital will be recycled to other activities that will improve the water quality.
Okay, I'm just going to move on now to the cultivation setbacks. Schedule C9. Kiro Farm seeks this stringent setbacks for cultivation on land with a slope of less than 10 degrees. So they're seeking 2 metres from drains and internal water courses and 3 metres from any outer water body, down from 5. And I just want to go to the water quality joint witness statement, which is in volume 401, tab 1. Question 37, which is page 401.0024. And there's a graph there which shows 4 different studies of the relationship between sediment removal and setback limit. And we've got a 5 metre marker there, which is the first number on that horizontal axis. So in all cases, all 4 of these studies, the returns diminish as setback width increases, that would be fair.
That's correct.
And if we take the current council version, 5 metres, that would capture the steepest part of most of those curves, do you think?
No. No, not necessarily. So it probably captures the sweeping study and the maybe jamming, but they'll check this quite flat.
They are quite flat, but they do leave them off. But after 5 metres?
Well, I don't know, but this is an infinite of those curves. Certainly, between the exam, what approach is your suggestion?
Yeah, okay. And now if we look at those graphs and decrease the setback, let's say down to 2 metres or 3 metres, they're not marked out on the axis, but you can approximate perhaps 3 metres with the first. So the second set of dots there.
Yep.
That does sort of move significantly, reduce sediment removal efficiency as you go towards zero, doesn't it?
It does to zero.
And again, I'm going to just pick up on time frames again, but this is a different provision now. Schedule D1, standard 6B and 6D. So D1 standard 6B requires all existing races, laneways, culverts, crossing and bridges to be relocated, redesigned or managed to meet standard 6A within 3 years of PC1 becoming operative, and that's the limit to 6A is to prevent ponding and direct runoff from permanent or intermittent water bodies. And you, in your ministry, raised concerns about cost to farmers and proposed a 5-year time frame instead.
Yeah.
I just want to hear from you what this work would involve on the ground. Would it mostly involve surface contouring and drainage channels to direct runoff away from water bodies, or is that the main thing?
It depends. So, I mean, it could be in one sort of the smaller circumstances, maybe it's something about reshaping the race. It could also require, you know, that race realignment. It could be, you know, involve moving culverts. It could be, you know, completely redirecting races and that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's going to vary from farm to farm. When that happens on arterial routes of the farm, it'd be pretty disruptive. So it's not something you necessarily can undertake at all times of the year. There'll be weather constraints during
again, we've got a similar situation to the previous questions on fencing timeframes, where you've got a spectrum of the work that's required and the ability of the farmer to comply with the timeframe.
Well, there is. I mean, in situations where every farmer will leave it to the last minute to be compliant, it's probably a little bit unfair. I think the reality is that these are often significant capital works that require a great deal of planning and funding. And I think that the reality is that most farmers recognise they have obligations under the plan, whether they end up in it, and will take steps to make sure they can try and achieve those to the best of their ability. The simple reality is that if a builder can't be paid, a builder can't be paid for much. But I think that's the risk I'm trying to highlight here, too, is that we're asking a lot of farmers over a very truncated period of time, and all the will in the world and desire from people to achieve those things won't necessarily be able to occur.
Okay, and just finally, on that issue, so this is a standard, a Schedule D1 standard, which applies to permitted activities effectively. If a large farm couldn't meet the standard within a 3-year time frame, they could address the issue through a Schedule D2 farm environment plan. Is that your understanding?
I think that's my understanding.
Now I'm just going to get on to this issue of multi-property farms, which you address in Section 8 of your evidence in chief. And I did ask Mr. McGibbon some questions about this.
You did.
This morning you were here and you knew that.
Of course.
So paragraph 8.1, which is on page 43 or 408 of the paginated version.
Yeah.
They say that under the current definitions in Part B of PC1, it would seem that the WRC envisages that only continuous land in common ownership operated as a single unit is considered a property for the purpose of the plan, such as determining activity status and the application of the rules. I took Mr. McGibbon to Rule 3.11.4.4, Condition 5, which is on page 28, where it says, you're familiar with it? Essentially, the condition is it needs to be a single property or to be more than one property, if it's a single operating unit, as defined in the glossary.
Yeah, so, familiar with that?
Okay. And in the council's version, which has been proposed to be amended by Federated Farmers, but they had a note at the beginning of the rules which said where a farm environment plan is to be prepared, it may be prepared for a single property or a single operating unit as defined in the glossary. So a similar approach to farm environment plans as the conditions for consent in the rules. You understand that? And perhaps given that you've heard it step through with Mr. McGibbon, I can cut to the chase a little more, but in terms of that definition of single operating unit, it doesn't matter whether properties are in common ownership or leased.
No, so the first version, that's correct. I'm pretty sure I'll make it some cheese based on the decision version because it's a triple post. So I agree with you, Sue, that as is the version that's in front of me now, I thought does not have to be an early story and the input.
Okay. Would it follow that you don't need to add your reference to lease property to the definition of property, or is that a question for someone else? And I did note also the examples that you see out in paragraph 8.2. But I think perhaps I was going to take you to those, but I think we would have got to with that discussion. I don't need to labour that point any further, so I'll move on from that. And this is just the last point, and it relates to critical source areas. In a second paragraph, it comes up in paragraph 4.5 of your evidence in chief. And this is under the heading, the big heading, stock exclusion, and then the bold heading, water body definition. And you talk there about increased awareness of critical source areas, and say that the federal water courses are well understood. And just to be clear, PC1, it doesn't propose that critical source areas need to be fenced, does it? Just that they need to be identified and managed effectively through the final planning process.
That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you. No further questions.
No questions, sir.
I only have one line of questions which relates to the nitrogen risk scorecard discussion of your evidence in chief, which is between paragraphs 330 to 341. My question in particular relates to your paragraph 339, which is on page 16. Particularly the final sentence of that paragraph. It's not clear to me at what NRS score that the risk of contaminated farm is such that a change in activity status is warranted, but I am sure this could be intuitively ascertained through validation. Now it's that last part that I would appreciate some clarification as to what you're suggesting there, thank you.
Sure. So the point there is that the NRS scorecard is a measure of risk, but it's not clear necessarily how that level of risk relates to contaminant load or contaminants, you know, in the sense of water bottles and bodies. So in terms of determining, just using the NRS as a tool to assess activity status is based on risk, there needs to be some linkage idea to the receiving environment so that understand at which point on the curve a farm business would be at risk of delivering a contaminant load that is unacceptable to a receiving environment. So I guess my point there is that, you know, it would be really useful if that wasn't the intention, that actually there was clear that an in-risk scorecard and an in-risk score in some areas may be different to an in-risk score in other areas in terms of its impact on the receiving environment. So I was suggesting that it was probably important to have some linkage there if in the end it's supposed to be a true measure of
right, and so when you say intuitively ascertained through validation, what are you suggesting there?
Well, I'm suggesting that in the absence of the science that we have to actually link output from land to the load in the water, you know, we're looking at first principles and understanding how water flows to the environment and the relative riskiness of the environment might be a way to to the appropriate status for the EMU levels that was based in, because the reality is we don't have the time or the science available to empirically link the observations in the environment to activity on the farm.
I see. So it wasn't just a suggestion that with a list generated by Fonterra of those farms above the 25th percentile that are caught in that higher risk category, it's not the ground truth that it's not what you're suggesting.
Well, I think I was suggesting that in terms of, I think that what I'm saying there is about the question of whether or not you should use percentiles or score. And so in my view, if you're going to use score, that needs to be linked to the actual effect on the receiving environment. Percentile approach is simply around drafting the relative risk. It's about the relative risk of one farm system to another farm system, mm-hmm. as opposed to its risk to the actual environment.
I see.
So that was the context of that point.
Okay.
We should use percentiles, we use action ones.
And your preference is?
I don't have a preference, to be fair. It depends what outcome.
just on that point, Mr. Matheson, it seems that the view of a number of witnesses who tried to analyse either overseer outputs or risk scorecard scores is that we're a long, long way off having an empirical set to do that correspondence, aren't we? So the percentile allocation, as it were, of categories seems to be all that's left to us.
Yes.
So then the question is whether or not 25%, 50% has the percentile cutoffs, whether that's fair and equitable. Are you in a position to offer a view on that?
No, no, I don't think I am. I mean, I think you raise a good point, Your Honour, and it's also to do with the practicality of the implications of having the number of farms in the next of these steps. So there's going to be a balance between both the relative equity between individual farm businesses and landowners and the practicality of implementation.
Well, a previous witness, of course, expressed the view that one of the problems with putting people into an activity status requiring them to apply for resource consent is that you could generate resistance. And so one question is whether or not we can achieve the same outcomes without necessarily saying, at our school certificate, we have to put so many people in various percentile bands. I don't know if you've been in the witness box over a break before, but now that you're under cross-examination, you shouldn't talk to anybody about your evidence for the next 15 minutes. We'll come back and we'll see if there are any other questions for you.
So I just said yes.
That's an interesting phrase to use. Thank you.